Hello, everyone.
Okay, so let's pick up where we left off. So we just finished chapter one. And chapter one ended on this note of Agada. Sorry, what's your question about, Judith? so this is the... So we had this this Agada about God punishing people in the way that they sinned, and God rewarding people in the way that they did good things. And that was all hooked onto the Sotah, but basically unrelated to the Sotah. And we had the whole story of Shimshon and Avshalom, and then Miriam, and then finally we ended with the story of how God buried Moshe, just like God buried Moshe. God actually is involved in everyone, in all of the Tzadikim's funeral. And now we've sort of left that aside, and we're coming back to the Sotah ceremony, and we're going to continue the description. We're sort of entering the narrative phase of the ritual, and we're going to just narrate through the through what happens, and we're going to need the verses to carefully compare the verses with what's going on, because it relies a lot on the knowledge of the verses. Okay, so if you remember back over here, we saw this, that the husband brings for his wife, or with his wife, a sacrifice for her of asirit ha'efa kemach so'orim, a tenth of an efa of barley flour. And it doesn't have shemen, it doesn't have oil, and it doesn't have levona, frankincense, doesn't have any incense, frankincense, whatever that is. It is a minchat kin'ah, kana'ot, minchat kana'ot, a jealousy offering, a minchat zikaron, a remembrance offering, mazkeret avon, one that remembers sin. So this has some similarities with the normal sin offering that you can bring, which can be an animal, but can be some amount of flour. But the sin offering you would bring, as we're going to see, is wheat, and wouldn't have the oil or frankincense. Other wheat sacrifices, like the mincha, would have oil and frankincense. So already you can see that this offering is sort of pulled out as a bit of a unique offering here, and we're going to end up talking about that. So now we're going to start talking about that offering. He would bring, the husband would bring her mincha offering, her grain offering, in an Egyptian basket, back to the Egyptian materials. He would place it in her hands in order to tire her out. The point being that the whole point of this ordeal is to get her to confess. So you want to do anything you can in order to make her confess. This is another thing which you can do. Kol hamanachot tachilatan v'sofan b'chli sharet, v'zo tachilata b'chfifa mitzrit v'sofa b'chli sharet. Now we're going to take an aside and just talk about the ways in which this offering is different, that I already started alluding to other offerings that one brings. So all manachot grain offerings are brought in the beginning and at the end in a vessel of service, a temple vessel, like a properly dedicated temple vessel. From the start to the end of the mincha, you bring the grain in a properly dedicated vessel. But this particular sacrifice, this one begins in an Egyptian basket, which is why we're talking about this right now, and ends in a sanctioned temple vessel, which we'll see in a later Mishnah here. So this is unique in the sense that the start of it is not a normal grain offering. Normal grain offerings have to be brought to the priest in temple vessels. Here it's brought to the priest in an Egyptian basket, but then later will be transferred to a temple vessel. It doesn't tell us why, the difference, but that's what it is. I think there's like ways in which this is like a normal sacrifice and ways in which this isn't. So we've already seen that it's outside the temple, at the gate of Nicanor, where they would purify the people with tzara'at and the women who'd just given birth. So it's already sort of like has some ways in which it's normal sacrifice, some ways in which it's not. And here's another way in which it is not. Kol hamanachot tu'unot shemen o levona, v'zo eina tu'una lo shemen v'lo levona. Normally, grain offerings require oil and frankincense. This requires neither oil nor frankincense, as the Torah explicitly excluded those two things. When the Mishnah makes a claim like this, like kol hamanachot, it doesn't always mean kol exactly, like all of them. It normally means just like in general, because I just told you that actually the sin offering shouldn't have oil and frankincense, but if it's a grain offering. Kol hamanachot ba'ot min hachitin v'zo ba'a min ha'sorin. And normally, and again, we'll see an exception in a second. So again, it doesn't mean kol is an all other, but just generally. Meal offerings come from wheat. This comes from barley. Minhat ha'omer afal pi sheba'a min ha'sorin hi haita va'a geres v'zo ba'a kemach. There is actually an exception to this, which is the offering of the mincha. The offering of the mincha, which is barley, it does come from barley because it's celebrating the start of the barley harvest. This is the offering that you bring on the 16th of Pesach, 16th of Nisan, the second day of Pesach, in order to permit the new grain at the start of the counting of the Omer. That's what the Minchat Omer is. You can't eat any of the new grain grown in that year until the Minchat Omer has been brought. That came from Sorin, but it was Geres, which is a form of sifted flour, versus the Kemach that we have, which is unsifted flour. So again, it would be a more fine flour for this offering than it would be for the Omer offering. It would be a finer flour than this offering, which is a lower level flour. So all in all, you can see that the requirements for this are extremely loose. The point of this is to be a very minimalist sacrifice. It comes from very cheap grain, barley. It doesn't have to even come with in the temple vessel. It doesn't have oil or frankincense. It would be very plain, and it's made from basic, even the basic of barley flour. Shebachol haylot anu achlin in four questions. Another example of kol meaning usually. Yes, that's true, Bummer. Okay, then we get a reasoning for why it's barley, but we don't get a reasoning for why anything else. I'm suggesting that because it actually is called something very unique here. There's no other sacrifice which is called minchat zikaron, because the chatat is supposed to purify you of sin. That's what at core the root chatat or chait is the root of purification. So the chatat is supposed to cleanse you of your sin, whereas this doesn't seem to cleanse anything. It's minchat zikaron. It just remembers the sin. So it doesn't have exactly the same effect as a normal sin offering. And so that's what I'm suggesting is really what's going on here. Like they're picking up on that kind of terminology and seeing this is only a sort of a sacrifice and not a real sacrifice, and therefore has all of these extra leniencies. But Rav Gamliel comes along and explains why it's barley specifically. Rav Gamliel omer kashem shema'aseha ma'asei behema kach korbanah ma'achal behema. Rav Gamliel says that just as she acted in the way of animals, so too the food that her offering is the food of animals, i.e. barley. Barley is normally what animals eat, as opposed to wheat, which is what humans eat. Great, I'm glad that question was resolved. Okay. So that's the differences between that offering and other offerings, and then we're going to continue along with the description of the ceremony. Is it to be a reference to the woman remembering? Say a little bit more about that, but that sounds interesting, Carla. Okay, continuing on our description. Haya mevi fayali shel cheres chadasha. Now we're going to move on to the next part of the ceremony, which is the water. So let's make sure we look at those verses. The verse says explicitly here, the priest takes holy water in a clay vessel, and from the dirt, the dust that is on the ground of the Mishkan, the Kohen picks it up, takes it, and puts it towards the water. This El Hamayim is going to be picked up in a second. Literally, it just means El Hamayim is towards the water, as opposed to Bamayim, which would be in the water. So that'll be picked up in a second. But this is also a very odd phrase, Bekarka HaMishkan. Mostly sacrifices in the Torah, sometimes they reference the Mishkan, specifically the tabernacle. Most of the time they're pretty vague and it could apply to the Mishkan or the temple. Here we're going to see, it's interesting that they specify Mishkan here, like it's supposed to be just earth, as opposed to the temple, which was paved. So you'll see how they got around that in a second. Great. Is it God remembering her sin, or is it her remembering her sin, what she did? That's a really interesting point. Or is it like supposed to remind people, other people, of her supposed sin? Yeah, it's very unclear. The ministering vessels and the reed baskets, were they provided by the temple, or was it be your own container? Bring your own container. Yeah, so ministering vessels, they belong to the temple. You would often bring your offerings in your own containers, and that probably is the case here. It's probably your own basket. Egyptians, by the way, were very well known for making their baskets and ropes, apparently. Somebody emailed that to me. I don't remember who, I'm sorry. Yes. And the other thing is, you said, these are translated as husband, not the priest. Who does? Oh, you mean here, where it says the priest brings the bowl of the earthen bowl, and he translates as husband. Yeah, great. Newsless translations are always 90% good. So I don't know. You have to do some more research into that. Okay. So anyway, so now we're talking about the water and how we get the water. So he brings the bowl of cheres, the new earthenware bowl, and puts in it a half a log of water from the laver, from the wash basin in the temple. A log is some amount of water. Rabbi Yehuda Omer revit, a quarter of a log, much less water. And now we have a little note, which is a mnemonic to actually remind us how to hold Rabbi Huda's opinion, because he has an opinion in this Mishnah and he has another opinion in the next Mishnah. So this is just a quick mnemonic to remind you what his opinion is about the water in both of these Mishnayot. Kashem shemama'it biktav, kach mama'it bamayim. Just as he reduces in text, he also reduces in water. So this is Rabbi Yehuda is the subject here. The point being that later on he's going to have the minimalist position of how much of the curses the priest has to actually write on the scroll, which will be put in the water, versus here he has a minimalist position on how much water it even needs to be in the cup. So he holds the minimalist position on both of them. He reduces the amount of water and also reduces the amount of writing, which probably makes a certain amount of sense given that there's less water, so probably there's less writing. So that's the first thing. So the water now comes from the sanctioned water from the wash basin in the temple. So that's important. Also, it was a new pot, a new earthenware bowl. Not totally obvious what that's about. This fiali is a fairly normal Greek word for a bowl or something where you like would do libations in, or what's the word? Or you'd boil liquids in it. It's just a fairly common kind of vessel. Nichnas laheichal ufana lemino. He would enter the sanctuary. This is definitely the priest, even if the first bit is the husband. but I think it's got to be the priest. Ufana lemino, and he would turn to his right. And there, umakom hayasham ama al ama, v'tavla shel shayish v'tabat hayta kvuaba. And right there on his right, near the just in front of the Nicanor gate, right? So he's at the Nicanor gate. He walks into the sanctuary, through the Nicanor gate. Walks, looks to his right. Right there, there's a block in the like a block of pavement of one ama squared. It's a marble tablet, tavla shel shayish. The tabat, tavla is just literally the word tablet, by the way, by Greek, table. And there is a ring that is affixed in the thing. It's basically a trapdoor. So there's a metal ring, and you can pull up the metal ring in order to reveal the earth underneath. So this is how they get around having like access to dirt right there and then, even though the temple was paved. They had a special trapdoor great. Blackman agrees with Newsner. Great. we can do some quick research in a second. I'll do some research on Safari and we'll see. Anyway, Because this translation, by the way, right, the translation on Safaria are communally sourced, so that you can't always trust them either. So it's a little trapdoor under which you would get the earth, as we'll see in a second. Ukshehu magbiha, when he lifted it up, the priest, notel afar mitachteha notein kadei sheyira'el amayim. He would take some dust from beneath it, and then would put it in order to, it should be seen on the water. So sort of sprinkles it on the surface of the water that's in this clay bowl. Shneamar umin afar asher yihavakarka hamishkan yikacha kohen v'natan el hamayim. So this is where the el hamayim comes in. He doesn't have to like make sure it gets dissolved in the water or goes in the water in general. It just goes el hamayim, towards the water. He just sort of sprinkles it on. It should remain on the surface. And then that's just a very fine reading of the pasuk. The el hamayim as opposed to b'mayim means that it has to be on the surface. Let's do a quick 5 second check. Yeah, is there any physical basis for this trapdoor in the temple ruins? I don't know if you could ever find that out. Let's see what Bartanura says. Hayamevi hakohen, the priest. So Bartanura already thinks this is the priest. So I don't know. Bartanura is a rabbi. Who else do we have? Seems like the traditional reading is the priest here. So maybe they have a Neuser and Blackman have an academic reading here, but the traditional Jewish reading seems to be the priest. Okay. Great. So that was all about the water, where they got the dust from, what kind of vessel the water was in, how much water they needed. That's all the kind of thing you'd expect the Mishnah to talk about. When the Torah gives you sort of vague instructions about put some water and some dust in it, you'd expect the Mishnah to go through and explain exactly how much dust, how much, where they get it from, how much water, where they get it from, etc. So that's that was about the water. Then we're going to go until the, now we'll talk about the scroll. So let's bring up the verses about the scroll. The Kohen makes her swear, and then the priest says it here, V'chatav et ha'alot ha'ele ha'kohen ba'sefer u'macha elmei ha'marin. The priest writes these curses in a scroll. Sefer means scroll, as in the sense of Sefer Torah. U'macha elmei ha'marin. And it gets rubbed off, it gets dissolved, again, towards the bitter waters. Okay, so this is all the instructions about the writing that you get. The instructions you get is that it's the writing of these curses, and that it's in a scroll, and that it should disintegrate. That's all going to play out in this Mishnah. Just to also go through the actual curses. So if you were trying to work out how much, what the piece actually had to write, there's a bunch of different options. So you see here, the Kohen administers the oath, says, the oath part is if you haven't had sex with a man, or if you haven't defiled your husband or whatever, then you'll be free from this. But if you did do those things, then that's bad. And then there's a break here. Bishpia Kohen et Aisha is just a repeat of an earlier thing, right? It just says that here the priest will administer the oath, and here again the priest will administer the oath. So you're probably going to skip this line, maybe. Because it's not part of the curses, it's just part of the instruction. Then the curses maybe continue. Yitain Adonai Otach La'ala L'Shvua B'toch Hameich. This is now the consequences of the oath. Then the curse is the actual punishment. Uvbo Hamayim Amarim Ha'ela B'me'ayich L'tzbot Baten Beten V'nin Pol Yarech. Also this is just the description of the curse, of what will happen if she has done this. And then V'amra Hisha Amin Amin. The woman responds, Amen, Amen. Amen to what is going to be a question that's going to come up in a second. But also, this is clearly not part of the curses. This is just, again, the woman's response, part of the instructions. So there's a bunch of different options I think you have as to which part is referred to by these curses. You could think it's the entire passage without the instructional pieces, like the priest adjuring the woman. Or you might think that it's just this last part, in some form, which actually contains the curse itself. This is in Bamidbar, Numbers 5. So there's a bunch of different options. You'll see those played out here. Ba'alo lichtov et hamigila. The priest comes to write the scroll. They've translated the word sefer as megillah. Sefer as in scroll, megillah as in scroll. Me'ezamakam hu chotev. From where From what place does he start writing? And now we're going to play out the options we have. Me'im lo shachab ish va'at ki satit tachati sheikh ve'eino chotev v'hishbiah kohen et ha'isha v'chotev yitein adnai otach la'alav v'lishfuah ba'u ha'mai marim ha'ila v'me'ayich l'tzbot baten v'lin pol yarech ve'eino chotev v'amra ha'isha amen amen. So this first option of the majority opinion is the entire text, missing off v'hishbiah kohen. You start off with Im lo shachav ishotach. That's where you start. You go down here. You skip the instruction that's in this verse, v'hishbiah hakohen et ha'isha, and then you continue along with avau mayim marim, and you skip the end of amar ha'isha amen amen. So the anonymous opinion here, the majority opinion, thinks that you go through the entire text of what the priest says. Rabbi Yossi Omer, lo haya mafsik. He wouldn't break it up. In other words, he doesn't think that you miss out the words here. Doesn't think that you miss out the instructions. He thinks that once you've started writing the verses, you just continue writing the verses. So he has a slightly longer version where it starts im lo shachav ish, and then goes on through all of these verses, including the instructional part, continues on and ends with v'amra ha'isha, amen, amen. Doesn't include that part, presumably. Yes, I guess Kohen Tezei Priest, since the basis is from Numbers and they use the word Kohen. Yes, exactly. So, yeah, though it says earlier on that the husband has to bring, so it's a bit confusing, because if you look, this husband certainly brings her offering, but then the priest brings her forward and stands her before God at the Nicanor gate. So there are multiple people doing things, but it definitely does seem to mean that, because it says that the priest gets the water. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. The priest that takes the water there. So that's why I think they did that. Anyway, so great. So Rabbi Yossi has a slightly longer version, which includes the instruction. He thinks that once you're started writing verses, you may as well just finish writing the verses. There's no reason to miss out anything. Rabbi Huda Omer, as we already know, Rabbi Huda has the smallest version that you could do. Kol atzmo eino chotev, ela yitein Adonai otach la'ala v'lishvua, uva humay marim ha'ele, me'ayich v'eino chotev amreisha, amen amen. So he thinks you start only from the second instruction. V'shbiya ha'kohen at ha'isha v'shvua ta'ala, v'amar ha'kohen la'isha, yitein Adonai otach. He thinks you start there, over here, which is to say that he thinks the first part is just an oath, and not the curses, and that the curses themselves begin with this instruction, v'hishbiya ha'kohen. So that's that. So that's Rabbi Huda's position. So now we know what we were talking about above when we said Rabbi Huda has a lower level of text. He thinks that only the end of the passage is written down in the Megillah. Okay. What's the rationale for Rabbi Yossi's position that even the stage instructions and the woman response must be included? Richard. So I don't know whether Rabbi Yossi thinks that you also include the Amra Ha'isha, Amen, Amen. That's a little bit up for debate. I'm not sure what the commentators would say here. Because Mafsik literally means to break, to interrupt. And that's the last words of the passage. So he could hold, for sure, that you go all the way until V'amra Ha'isha, Amen, Amen, or that you stop before V'amra Ha'isha, and that still wouldn't be a Mafsik, that wouldn't be a Hafsaka. That wouldn't be a break. It wouldn't be skipping anything. So yes, I think the rationale basically is once you're writing psukim, you may as well just write psukim. Like, why make it complicated? Just write the passage. I think that's basically where he's coming from. And also the fact that somebody might have these psukim memorized, and it might be easier for them to just write out the entire passage than to consciously skip a section. It's just easier to just write it all out. So I think those are the two things that he might be thinking. Jealous husband, accused wife, priest, or other any dramatis personae, witnesses, just the three of them. So yeah, so you'll see that her family is there, the wife's family is there, and there are witnesses for the warning, and there may be witnesses for the seclusion, but that was probably already dealt with in the town that they came from. There are no witnesses that need to come to the court in Jerusalem. She's already been found a sota by the local court, and before she even comes to Jerusalem. And if we had witnesses, we wouldn't need this ritual to find out if she's guilty or not. Exactly. Those would be witnesses of the actual act, witnesses that had, that warned her, that said to him, her and the man, she's like, just so you know, you're committing a capital offense, etc. Like, they'd have to warn her about it and see it happen. And if they did, then that would end up being adultery. Great. Yeah, if you're skipping, you're more likely to make a mistake. Yes, that's true. Yeah, although I also like the idea that you're not, you don't want to elevate some words of the Torah over others. Yeah, all the words of the Torah are holy, so you might not want to skip the ones that don't make any sense. Great, but good. Judith, that's actually a great point, which is that the majority opinion might be that they want to skip verses so that you can reduce the amount of Torah that gets destroyed. Yeah, I think that could well be it. By the way, talking about the name of God being in the waters, the reason we know the name of God is in the waters is because everyone agrees that it has this this line, Yitain Adonai Otach. Every single person agree, each one of the opinions agrees that it has this word Adonai, the Yod Heh Vav Heh, the full name of God. And that's why this is such a big deal, erasing the actual name, the fully written out name of God, the time when you're mandated to do it. But I did want to clear that when that's how the Mishnah understands it, but it's not the only reading of the Torah. You could come up with V'chatav et ha'alot ha'ele, ha'kohen b'sefer. You could come up with a situation where you wouldn't have to write God's name, you wouldn't have to write the whole passage verbatim, you just have to sort of write out the basic summary of the curses. So there's definitely a plausible reading of the Torah that wouldn't involve erasing God's name. But that's not the way the Mishnah goes here. If only absorbing Torah was as easy as drinking it in. So true. But Torah is compared to water in a whole bunch of places. Great. You could take the prophetic approach of eating the scroll. Yes, that's true. Wouldn't be very tasty, I think. Okay, thank you, everyone. We will continue on next time. We'll continue talking about the writing of the scroll. And then we're going to talk about her Amen, Amen at the end. And that's going to close up chapter 2 and move into chapter 3.